All right, gang, when we left off last time, we were talking about the crisis of the 1850s, and we had wrapped up with talking about the Dred Scott decision and the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and finally with John Brown's raid, okay? And I promised you that next we would get to that crazy election of 1860. As we've been talking about all semester, election years are always fun to watch to kind of take the pulse of the United States. But as you can see from what's up there on the outline, and we're going to wind up with four presidential candidates, two from the same party, obviously things are about to get really crazy. Okay? Now, set the stage for me. Remind me, what happened with the Dred Scott decision that was so important? What are y'all going to need to remember to put in your essays? The significance. Oh, wait, I'm not supposed to ask questions. Damn it. I'll tell you. Dred Scott decision, number one, the biggest thing you need to remember, beyond the date. And remember, y'all are fine if you just tell me late 1850s, I'm happy. All right, you don't have to remember March of 1857. The significance that I want you to remember is that it changes how Americans are going to be able to approach the idea of compromise. All right, remember, from that point forward, the Supreme Court has ruled under Justice Taney, any line saying from here on up is free and from here on down is slave, anything like that is Fifth Amendment property rights violation. Okay? Lincoln Douglas, remember, have those famous Senate debates, that Senate campaign in 1858, and that's when they're hashing out a lot of those ideas. Okay? Hashing out what the country writ large is arguing. You can see it through the lens of Illinois. 1859, we talked about John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, right? And Southerners in particular worried about the fact that there are portions of the North, by no means all, but portions of the North that are very much mourning the execution of a man who was going to launch a slave rebellion that would have led to a lot of the deaths of Southern whites, okay? So by the time we get to 1860, what you're seeing is a country that is falling apart and running out of ways to come up with some sort of compromise, some sort of a solution. Now, in that year, they're going to have to pick who they want for their presidential candidates, the different parties. All right? We talked about last time that in 1856, you've seen the birth of the Republican Party. You have the Democratic Party, which is fragmenting in terms of regions. You're getting kind of a northern wing and a southern wing of the Democratic Party. And what those two groups are going to have to do is come together and find out who they want the presidential candidate to be. Now, the Democrats decide to meet, for no apparent reason, certainly not a smart one, in South Carolina, the hotbed of the secession movement. Okay, that's where they go to try and talk about some sort of a solution to the crisis. Okay, again, not smart. They go down to Charleston. All right, Southern Democrats, okay, the Southern wing of the party, very much wants protections about the idea that slavery is going to be able to continue to expand into the territories. Okay, they want that option, that, you know, that we don't want to put it up to a vote, we don't want to make a popular sovereignty, we want some sort of protections that slavery is going to be able to continue to expand into the territories. The northern wing of the Democratic Party is saying we're going to have to come up with some sort of a compromise. Okay, we're not going to be able to hold a hard line on this issue anymore. The northern wing of the Democratic Party wants Stephen Douglas to be their candidate. Okay, but the southern wing is going to say no way. All right, they're going to say, look, Stephen Douglas, I mean, this is the guy who gave us popular sovereignty. This is the guy who put Fifth Amendment property rights up for a vote. Okay, no, he's compromising on things that we cannot compromise on. We can't afford to. Okay, and so what's going to happen is the southern wing of the Democratic Party is going to storm out of that convention. The Democrats are going to have to reconvene later. And in the end, what they come up with are two separate candidates. Southern Democrats are going to nominate John Breckinridge. Slaveholder, he's from the slave state of Kentucky. Okay. Northern Democrats are going to go with Stephen Douglas. Okay. Very experienced politician, moderate on a lot of the key issues that the Democratic Party holds dear. Looks like the guy who has the experience and the broad support to win an election. Problem is, you've already split your vote. Okay. If you remember, do you remember in the 90s when you would have Ross Perot, he'd be running, and the Republicans would just absolutely freak out. All right, Ross Perot is going to come in the election. He's going to siphon off some of those conservative votes. And the Republicans didn't like this. The Democrats were like, hey, the more the merrier. Come on in. This is good. Right? And around 2000 is when the Democrats had to start to deal with Ralph Nader coming in and siphoning off some of the liberal votes. And the Republicans were like, hey, the more the merrier. Come on in. This is good. Now what you're seeing is this split in the Democratic Party, which is absolutely going to wrench any sort of a block vote that's going to give them the majority. All right? So when you see a party splintering like this, it's your clear sign that something is seriously wrong. They know what they're doing. These are not idiots. All right? They know what's going on, but they cannot come up with a compromise that they can sleep with at night. And they know in many ways they're probably committing political suicide here, but they don't know what else to do. Now, the Republicans need to come up with a candidate who can win. Okay? 1856, we saw them give us John Fremont. And the country kind of looked at John Fremont and looked at the Republicans, and they're awfully new, and I don't know, they're pretty radical. And yeah, they're not all abolitionists, but that's where the abolitionists tend to hang out, and that's just a little too radical for me, and we're going with Union. Okay? Now, the Republicans look at one of their main contenders, all right? His name is William Seward. William Seward is one of the main candidates the Republicans are going to think about for the election of 1860. Put him forward. Okay? Seward's from New York. Very talented politician, eloquent speaker. I'll give you an excerpt of Lincoln's inaugural address later on here in a little bit. It's beautiful. I mean, Lincoln's got those writing skills. I mean, you just can't teach somebody to write like that. I mean, it is just beautiful. And there are lines in Lincoln's address that actually William Seward gave him. Okay, so Seward's a very talented politician in his own right. Problem for the Republicans with Seward is, number one, he's from the Northeast. He's from New York. All right, and they need to get some Western votes because, remember, Douglas is from the West. They're going to need to be able to siphon off some of those Western votes. Number two, he is a very outspoken opponent of slavery. Okay, there is no way to tell Southern Democrats that William Seward is a moderate on the slavery issue, that they're going to be able to work together on the slavery issue. All right, William Seward flat out is opposed to slavery. Needs to end now. So he's not going to be moderate enough, and what the Republicans end up doing is going with this fairly new, unknown guy by the name of Abraham Lincoln. Okay, he's not well known. If you remember from your reading, some of you all read that primary source essay where you're reading about Lincoln's position on the Mexican War. All right, he's had one term in Congress. That's pretty much it. He lost his Senate race in 1858 in Illinois. Okay, but he's this kind of rising star who's clearly a very talented speaker, clever debater. He's that kind of guy who, he's kind of got that classic Southern thing about him is what he has. You ever talk to somebody where, you know, they kind of talking a little slow and they look a little disheveled and you're like, all right, he's this country guy and he's this old guy, probably doesn't have that much education, and you're just kind of sitting around. Y'all probably don't. I do. I'm from the North. I fall for that trick. All right? And you're listening to him, you know, and you're just, all right. And the next thing you know, he's just lapped you three times. All right, that was Lincoln. All right, he tells these barnyard jokes, and, you know, he kind of got this aw shucks kind of style. And then, bam, he just kind of backhands you in the middle of a debate. All right, that's Lincoln. And what he's able to do is convince enough people that, you know what, he's got the brains for it, he's moderate enough to get enough votes, and he might just be able to pull this thing off. Okay? Now, the slavery issue, it's going to be something that the Republicans have to deal with. Remember what we talked about earlier this week. Okay, the Republican Party officially on the position of slavery is for containing it, not abolishing it. Okay, and what Lincoln's going to say is, hey, everybody just chill out. All right, I will protect slavery where it is. If I get elected, there's nothing to worry about. Okay, but what happened during those Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1858, y'all ever heard excerpts from his House Divided speech? A house divided against itself cannot stand. Okay, in that speech, he said that a country divided as we are, half free and half slave, cannot stand. We're going to have to choose all free or all slave. All right, we cannot keep going like this. Well, Southern Democrats look at him and they're just like, well, you can say compromise all you want. All right, but you said in 1858 we're going to have to choose one or the other. We just don't trust you. And what Lincoln does is he just kind of stays quiet. All right, once he gets the nomination, he just kind of keeps saying, look at my record, look at what I've said earlier, I'm just going to stay quiet on this issue. I will protect slavery where it currently exists. I'm morally opposed to it. Lincoln has a very famous story where he talks about seeing a slave family sold apart, literally a family sold apart in an auction, and how that absolutely shaped him. If you ever go to the Lincoln Presidential Library Museum in Illinois in Springfield, there's a big display on that. And he would talk about that, that morally he was opposed to it. But as a lawyer and as a constitutionalist, he fundamentally believed it was protected under the U.S. Constitution. All right? So he says, look, I'll protect it where it exists. I'm not going to support it extending any further. Okay? And that was his official position. So that leaves us with Abraham Lincoln representing the Republicans. We got Stephen Douglas representing Northern Democrats, John Rep Breckinridge representing Southern Democrats. And then you have a portion of the country that is still not happy. And they organize themselves into a political party for this election. And they are the Constitutional Unionists. Okay? Their slogan is, the Constitution as it is, the Union as it is. First time I ever read about the Constitutional Unionists, I was kind of sitting where you all are now, I always thought of them as the head in the sand party. I was like, well, there's a solution for you. All right? The Constitution is as it is, the Union as it is. Oh, great. All right, good. Yeah, we got that. All right? It's not working. But what's interesting about the Constitutional Unionists is actually the more you read about them, the more you'll notice what they're hoping to do in some ways is fragment this vote to the point where it gets thrown into the House. All right? And now we can debate it in the House. All right? Get it out of the passions of the American people, and let's see if we can't debate this among the experts. All right? And what they also are a bunch of wealthy guys who have a heck of a lot to lose if war actually comes from this, if everything falls apart. All right, these are a lot of your wealthy planters who have investments with northern banks. They've invested in railroads. These are the guys who are invested across the entire nation. These are the guys who are going to lose a lot if it comes to war. All right, these are not your radicals. So what they're going to have to come up with is some sort of a compromise, but they say at heart we always have to go back to the Constitution. We always have to go back to the Union. All right, that is who we are. That is how you end up in the fall of 1860 with four presidential candidates. And these are viable candidates. These aren't, you know, the crazy guy who managed to get on the evening local news. Okay? Four strong potential candidates. Constitutional Unionists put forward John Bell. They looked at a few options. Sam Houston, if you've heard him, all right, from Texas. He'd been the president of the Republic of Texas. He knew what it was like to literally lead a country. Sam Houston actually probably would have been a pretty good choice. The problem with Sam Houston for 19th century America is he was divorced from his first wife, and his second wife was a Cherokee woman, which for 19th century Americans, they weren't going to be able to wrap their head around either one of those things. So Sam Houston went out, John Bell came in as the much more palatable option. Okay. 1860, in November, Americans go to the polls. Okay, at least adult white male American citizens go to the polls. And this is how it winds up. Everything in green there goes for Lincoln. Douglas got Missouri and part of New Jersey. Breckinridge overwhelmingly gets the slave-owning South, except for some of those border states where you see in the dark brown there, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Virginia go to John Bell. Okay? And what's interesting about this is how the vote breaks down. Overwhelmingly, Lincoln wins the Electoral College. He gets a clear majority of the electoral votes, which is all you need to become president. Okay? But in terms of the popular vote, okay, Lincoln gets about 39%. But because it was so split, and the way the Electoral College works, he's going to win the presidency. The problem is a huge portion of the country, particularly the South, is going to feel like the guy that they didn't vote for, who didn't even appear on a lot of deep South ballots, state of Texas, Lincoln wasn't even on Southern ballots in the state of Texas. All right, it's not like he was getting a whole lot of write-in votes. I mean, there was no way they were going to vote for the Republican. No. All right, he's a nut. He's from the North, you know, Illinois to boot. All right, there was no way they were going to do it. Okay, so a huge portion of the country feels like, forget it. We didn't even vote for this guy. There are other factors going on, too. When you look at, you know, again, kind of looking at here, the Union is dissolved, kind of reactions to Lincoln's victory is where I'm at. I mean, if you look at the situation, if y'all have ever voted for a candidate who's lost, okay, and we've talked about this before when we've talked about other presidential elections, you always console yourself, right, that, all right, in four more years, we'll come back and we'll win next time, okay? Problem for huge portions of the South is that they're convinced with a Republican in the White House, laws are going to change to the point where they'll never be able to reclaim the White House again, or they will always be outvoted. Territories are going to come into the Union's states. They're worried they're going to come in as free states. Democrats are going to lose more and more power. 50, where is that stat I wrote down? There we go. Southern states, slaveholders to boot, slaveholders had controlled the presidency for 50 of the last 72 years. Okay? American presidents have been slaveholders controlling the presidency for 50 of the last 72 years. No party had directly, that's cool, no party, stop, technology is possessed, all right, had seriously challenged slavery until 1856. One election later in 1860, suddenly the Republicans are controlling the White House. And what's going to happen is portions of the Deep South are going to decide, forget it, okay, we cannot continue to exist as one nation. Now, the way it's going to happen is South Carolina is going to be the first one out. South Carolina secedes about a month, a little over a month after the election. Lincoln gets elected in early November, first week of November 1860. South Carolina secedes from the Union, and you remember in your essays, it's secede, not succeed. Okay? It's all right. A lot of people make the mistake. Just you're paying big bucks for an education. Make it sound like my computer's possessed. Stop. I'm not ready to go on. All right? South Carolina is going to secede from the Union in December. All right. Next state out is going to be Mississippi. Following Mississippi in January of 1861, you're going to have Florida, Alabama, Georgia, and Louisiana. And y'all, if you ever get confused and you're trying to remember all this, just go to the mapping section on your test, find South Carolina, work your way down the coastline until you get to Texas. Those are your first seven states of the Confederacy. All right, just find South Carolina and weave your way down. I will never ask you, all right, did Texas go in January or February? All right, I'm far more interested in why Texas goes than exact the month that Texas goes. You know this. All right, so South Carolina's the first out in December of 1860. Then you're going to get Mississippi is going to be next. And kind of that heart moving down from South Carolina of the Deep South where you get Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Louisiana. And then in February, you're going to get Texas. So what you'll have, let me jump to this map. Maybe, maybe not. What you end up seeing with the Deep South. Yeah, now it's going. Just picture the map. All right? South Carolina on down to Texas. Those are going to be the first seven states of the Confederacy. Okay? Now remember, because those states, when they go in direct response to Lincoln's election. Okay? They see Lincoln, and what they argue is that the country is falling apart, and the only way to preserve the principles of the founders is to cut away the basically decaying part of the country. All right? Cut away that gangrenous limb to save the life of the country. They're going to organize into the Confederate States of America, and the first capital is going to be in Montgomery, Alabama. I don't know why it's not going. There we go. Here, look at it there. Look at this one. This will help you remember it. The dark blue, those are your seven Deep South states that are the first to secede. Okay? South Carolina, on down to Texas. They go in response to Lincoln's election. And you need to remember this because it's going to be different motivations for the Upper South. Okay? You know, some days the magic works, and some days it just doesn't. Now, what's going to end up happening, that's me talking today, I'm glad we got that title in. What's going to end up happening is they're going to organize and they're going to meet Montgomery, Alabama. They're going to come up with their own state constitutions. They're going to revise all of them, okay? And they're going to come up with a new Confederate constitution. They're going to pick for their president that guy in the top right-hand corner, Jefferson Davis, okay? Y'all hopefully know him, being from Mississippi. Okay? He's familiar to most of y'all. Davis is an interesting character. I mean, yes, he's a West Point graduate. Yes, he commanded the Mississippi Rifles in the Mexican War. He's been Secretary of War in the 1850s. He has a lot of that background that's going to make him a very good choice in many ways, at least on paper. Okay? There's a famous quote that I put up there that talks about how Davis himself was never entirely sold on being president, that in many ways he had hoped to command troops in the field, but it's going to be that classic virtuous citizen argument that he is called upon to serve as president of the Confederacy, and as he was called, he will do. Okay. Now, in some ways, he was hesitant to do it. Okay. He wasn't entirely sure this is what he wanted to do. When Davis is sitting as a senator representing the state of Mississippi in the U.S. Senate in Washington City, when this all of this is happening, when the secession crisis is taking place, that winter of 60-61, okay, when those states, when those deep South states start to secede, he, as a very much kind of one of the leading senators, stands up to deliver the departure speech, kind of this goodbye, farewell address of the South, okay? And one of his classic lines from this is that the South has a high and solemn motive to defend and protect the rights which we inherited, which is it is our sacred duty to transmit unshorn to our children. If you look at Davis's inaugural address, he cites the Revolution, he cites the legacy of the Founding Fathers. In his inaugural address, I think not even once does he mention the word slavery. Okay? His vice president, a guy by the name of Alexander Stevens, flat out says, all right, we need to leave to protect slavery, period, end of story. And in some of Davis's other writings, he flat out says, look, you cannot have the federal government infringing on these rights. All right, this is it, end of story, we need to talk about it. Now, you need to get this in your notes because I'm going to want you to be able to debate this issue of kind of how people are reacting and pointing to these the Constitution and these inaugural addresses to look at this issue of slavery and its influence and its, how should we phrase it, how it ties into the causes of the Civil War. Okay, because you all know, or if you haven't heard, there's sometimes a big fight over was slavery the central issue of the Civil War? Was it not the central issue of the Civil War? This is classic material for an essay question for the last exam. Okay, hint, hitting you over the head with a hammer here. All right, you got it. What I want you to be able to do, remember, I don't want to know about your feelings. All right, I don't care if you had an ancestor who served in the 6th Wisconsin and therefore the Union is right and it's all about that. Okay, I mean, I care, but all right. Remember, I want to know what you think, okay? So I want you to be able to point to historical evidence and give me proof. And if you look at the Confederate Constitution, if you look at Confederate state constitutions, look at Mississippi's Constitution, okay, before the secession crisis and after, every single one of those Confederate constitutions increased protections for slaveholders, okay? Clearly, slave owners were worried about their rights as slave owners, were worried about property rights, and this was a clear motivation. Okay. If you want to make an argument, though, that slavery was not the only issue, okay, you can look at Davis's speech, but your stronger evidence is going to come from Union soldiers, and it's going to come from Lincoln's actions in the first year of this war. And we're going to get more into that when you get back on Monday and when you get back from Thanksgiving break, okay? Because Lincoln flat out will say he will put together he'll put the Union together with slavery, he'll put the Union together without slavery. It's all about the Union until late 1862. Okay, so if you want to look at the beginning of the war and argue about multiple motivations, there's your evidence. That's what I want you looking at. Okay? But remember, I don't care, you know, it's up to you to come to your own conclusions. I just want to make sure you're going to be able to defend it. Okay? And if you want to argue that it was fundamentally slavery, look at those constitutions. But you're also going to have to tie in the fact that Lincoln is willing to compromise on that issue of slavery in the beginning of the war. That Union soldiers will go off to war in 1861 flat out saying there is no way they are abolitionists. They are fighting to preserve the Union, period, end of story. Okay? So you've got to make sure you can get clear in your head the complexity of it all. All right? When I was a kid, some of the first historians I ever read, he was a guy by the name of Bruce Catton, wrote about the Civil War for years. And Catton once argued that in 1860, slavery wasn't the only issue that caused the war, but it was the one issue that Americans not only couldn't compromise on, it was that they didn't want to anymore. That they were so angry with each other, they just wouldn't compromise on that one anymore. They just didn't care to compromise anymore. And to me, that's the best way to characterize it. No war is ever about one thing, but that slavery became that one issue on which people got so mad, they didn't even want to try to get along anymore. All right, that was it. They were done. Okay? And it's one of the best characterizations of that I've ever heard. Now, Davis is going to rise to the presidency of the Confederacy, okay? Lincoln is going to have to try and keep what he can of the country together, all right? Can you imagine being Abraham Lincoln? I always think about this, all right? You got elected to the presidency of the United States. I mean, it doesn't get much bigger than that. This is huge. And 7 states leave the Union specifically because of you, Okay? I mean, seriously, ouch. All right? And so Lincoln's got to find a way to keep the country together. Now, as far as Lincoln's concerned, all right, the Confederacy does not exist. He never, there's one mishap where actually, kind of de facto, he recognizes the existence of the Confederacy. But in principle and in his speeches, all right, he never recognizes the existence of the Confederacy. All right, it's always the rebellious states, Southerners, the rebellious peoples, the rebel army, anything like that. He never actually recognizes the existence of those Southern states forming into an independent country. And what he tries to do in the spring of 1861, desperately, is keep everything together. Okay? And so what he's going to do in his inaugural address, remember they're in March in those days, is basically convince the South to come back into the fold. And he says, "In your hands, my dissatisfied countrymen, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war." Don't try and get this down. It's just cool. Just listen to it. You'll miss it if you try and get it down. "The government will not assail you. You can have no conflict without yourselves being the aggressors. You have no oath registered in heaven to destroy the government, while I have the most solemn oath to preserve, protect, and defend it." Okay, what he's saying is, look, I'm not going to start this thing, but I have just taken an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Union. Okay, so ball's in your court. What the Confederacy's arguing is that this is not a civil war. They don't want to overthrow the government in Washington. They want to go home. They just want to break away and form themselves into an independent country, and that's what they're arguing they've done. Okay, and so what happens by March of 1861 is you kind of have yourself in this kind of no man's land, this kind of deadlock, where we're not necessarily sure what we're going to be able to do. Okay? And everybody's just kind of staring at each other, wondering who's going to make the next move. And the next big critical move is going to come, shockingly, in Charleston, South Carolina. Okay? Now, in Charleston Bay, there are a couple of forts. And the U.S. Army commander in charge of those forts was a guy by the name of Robert Anderson. Major Robert Anderson. He couldn't hold on to everything, so he's consolidated all of his forces onto one of these islands where you have Fort Sumter. Okay? So you got Charleston, you have the harbor there, and in the harbor is Fort Sumter. Major Anderson has consolidated his forces there. Now, Anderson has orders to hold on to that fort. Yes, South Carolina has been saying since December that they are not part of the United States anymore. Yes, since February, you now have the Organization of the Confederate States of America. Yes, they're saying they're an independent nation and that you are illegally in their country as an enemy army. Okay? But as far as the U.S. government's concerned, we don't recognize the existence of the Confederacy. You stay right where you are. Okay? Anderson's problem? Okay? He's literally sitting in the hotbed of the secession movement in Charleston. He's on an island. He's going to run out of food and supplies at some point. Okay? Now, in January, the federal government, the U.S. federal government, tried to send a relief expedition down. Confederate forces fired on that ship, and it turned around. So ever since January, Anderson's been trying to hold out. And what he's saying is, guys, I don't know how much longer I can do this. All right? We've got a serious problem. Finally, in early April, Lincoln decides he's got to resupply Anderson. Okay? But here's Lincoln's problem. He doesn't want to start this thing. He's hoping that everybody's going to kind of, if you get wrapped up in the middle of a speech, right, you're at some sort of gathering, and there's like the electricity of the crowd, and this is amazing speech, and everybody's all excited, and yeah, all right, you're ready to go do it. Let's go do this, man. All right, and then you wake up the next morning, and you're like, oh, God, yeah, you know, let's just talk about it, okay? You know, it's just a little crazy, guys. I mean, I was kind of in the spirit there, but let's just chill out. All right, and I mean, a lot of these states are looking around like, we only got 7. I thought we were going to get more than 7. What happened? I thought Tennessee was with us. Missouri was serious about it. They were going to come. What happened? We got 7. That's not a lot. All right, we got 7 out of 33 states. We were hoping for more. So what they're going to have to do is try and figure out, do we keep going? Do we back up? I don't want to back up. I mean, that's just embarrassing. All right, and I really do believe in what we said, but I don't know if maybe we should have gone with a different option. Okay? And so what Lincoln's hoping is that enough Confederate leaders are going to start to say, look, let's see if we can't come up with a compromise. He does not want to give them a crisis to rally behind. All right, when you're trying to talk a guy down from a fight, all right, y'all are going to go to parties this weekend, all right, and it'll happen. If it didn't happen this weekend, it happened last weekend, all right, and two guys are going to want to get in a fight, all right, and hopefully some of you are going to be like, guys, come on, you know, seriously, back down, all right. The way to stop the fight is not to sucker punch one of the guys in the face, all right. Lincoln's saying, don't do anything. Everybody just chill out, okay. But he's got to provide some sort of support to Major Anderson. So on April 6th, 1861, Lincoln's going to send a message to the governor of South Carolina and say, look, his last name is Pickens, by the way, if you're curious. Francis Pickens, governor of South Carolina. And Lincoln's going to send him a message and say, look, we're sending a relief ship down. All right, this is not an act of aggression. Got fresh food, fresh water, medical supplies. We might put a couple guys in the fort, take a couple of sick guys out. This is just a relief expedition. We're not reinforcing the fort. This is not an act of aggression. The governor is looking at the situation and basically decides, I don't know. I'm going to pass this up the chain, see what everybody else says. And they send the message to Davis and his advisors. Jefferson Davis and his advisors talk about this on 2 days later, on the 8th of April, 1861. And they're debating it. Some of them think, look, let the relief expedition in because we do not want to fire the first shot. The Confederacy's whole argument is that we're not starting this thing. We don't even want a war. We just want to go. All right? We just want to break away. We're not trying to overthrow the government. We just want to break away. If they start this thing by firing on a federal installation, that weakens their whole position. Okay? Problem is, you've got a U.S. fort inside Confederate territory, as far as they're concerned, and you can't let that situation continue. So you're going to have to come up with some sort of a solution, and they don't want to let the fort get resupplied. They do not want to let that relief expedition through. Okay? So, on the 10th of April, 2 days later, on the 10th of April, the Confederate government tells Beauregard, say no. We're going to have to demand a surrender. All right. Now, Beauregard, who is he? Pierre-Gustave Tuton Beauregard. Great name. All right. We just don't name our kids that well anymore. PGT Beauregard, making life simpler for history students everywhere. All you have to remember is PGT Beauregard. Pierre-Gustave Tuton Beauregard. Beauregard is the Confederate commander on the ground in Charleston. The Confederate government's going to tell him, look, you're going to have to contact that fort out in the harbor and tell them, forget about it, okay? We're not letting a relief expedition through. You're going to have to surrender. Here's the really weird situation. Remember the guy I told you in the fort, the commander of the fort, Major Anderson? He was the artillery instructor at West Point when Beauregard was the student. So my students always love this at the end of the semester. So now the student is demanding that the professor surrender. So Beauregard sends this message to Anderson, right? Look, you're going to have to surrender the fort, okay? I mean, Beauregard had been one of Anderson's favorite students. They know each other well. Everybody's like, look, I'm sorry, bud, but I've got orders, and you're in the wrong as far as Beauregard is concerned. You're going to have to surrender the fort. Anderson sends a message immediately back. He says, look, I can't. I'm under orders to hold the fort at all cost. I will hold the fort at all cost. But I can't hold out much longer anyway. We are really low on food. We are really low on water. We're going to have to leave here soon anyway. So maybe we can come up with some sort of a compromise, all right? Let's not get a whole bunch of guys killed over nothing. And Beauregard gets the message, you know, and you can just imagine. He's like, all right, I wasn't expecting that. Soon. How soon is soon? You're going to have to leave soon. All right, and he sends a message back out to Anderson, and Anderson says, look, I tell you what, if I'm not relieved by noon on April 15th, I'll have to leave the fort. And what Beauregard knows is the relief expedition is going to get there before then. Anderson's going to get relieved, and we're going to be stuck in the same old situation all over again. It's just going to continue. Okay, so did you get the chain of events there? Lincoln sends a message to South Carolina on the 6th saying, look, we're sending a relief expedition down. This is just supplies. All right, we need to water, fresh food, some medical supplies. Basically, that's all it is. Governor Pickens sends the message on to President Davis and the Confederate cabinet. He says, look, what do you want me to do about this? Confederate government says, no, we can't have a relief expedition coming on, all right? They tell the military commander on the ground, all right, PGT Beauregard, the Confederate commander, to demand the surrender of the fort. Beauregard contacts his old friend, Major Anderson says, you need to surrender the federal forces inside that fort. Anderson says, nope, I can't. I'm under strict orders to hold out at all costs, but I tell you what, don't start shooting at us over nothing. I'm going to have to leave soon anyway, but I can't just surrender when you ask me to right now. All right. Beauregard writes back and says, you know how I always imagine? Who are the guys running these messages back and forth, rowing out with a message? Anyway, I always think about these things. So Beauregard sends a message back. Again, soon, how soon are you going to have to leave the fort? What are we talking about here? Anderson says, look, noon on the 15th. If I'm not relieved before noon on the 15th, I'm going to have to leave anyway. Beauregard knows, though, that federal ship is going to be there and resupplying the fort before the 15th, which means we're just going to be right back in this kind of purgatory that they've been living in for months. This is going to have to come to a head. Okay. So Beauregard sends a message back saying that's not going to work. You're going to have to surrender the fort. Anderson sends a message back saying, I can't. As long as I can hold out, I am under orders to hold out. And so at 4:30 in the morning on the 12th of April, 1861, Confederate forces inside Charleston opened fire on federal forces in Fort Sumter. That is the shot that starts the American Civil War. Okay? In 4 years, you're going to have 620,000 Americans dead. That doesn't include wounded. Okay? That's just dead. 620,000 in 4 years, North and South. And again, remember, but we know that. Nobody else knows that now. All right? What a lot of sides are hoping, there's worries that this might be longer than they think it will be. But a lot of folks are hoping this is going to be over quick. We're going to have one big fight. Southerners are convinced the North, the North is just a bunch of these guys, these clerks who work in, you know, factories. What do they know? All right, they don't hunt, they don't fish, they can't survive in the outdoors. That's what Southern men are all about. We're going to punch them in the face a couple times. They're going to run home to mama. It'll be all done. All right? Northerners are looking at the Southerners and like, yeah, great. You guys got drunk and you went gambling one more time. And, oh, this time you decided to break up the country. Way to go, geniuses. Thanks a lot. All right? And both sides are figuring it's going to take one fight. We're going to settle this thing once and for all. Okay? Now, when Confederate forces in Charleston open fire on Fort Sumter, that convinces Lincoln, okay, I need to do something. Okay? And you need to understand, Lincoln has been under a heck of a lot of pressure. All right, a lot of Northerners who want this war, who are saying, look, we have tried compromise, we have tried everything. All right, a lot of them are, there's a great line in one of the Northern newspapers says, Lincoln stands like an ass, can I say that, like an ass, between two bales of hay, wondering what to do, you know? I mean, you know, he's under all sorts of pressure, you know, just, you know, come on, do something, man. We didn't elect you to just sit there and stare. The last couple presidents did that. All right, but he's desperately trying to find some sort of a peaceful solution. Once Confederates open fire on Fort Sumter, U.S. military troops, U.S. military installation, no, that's not going to work. So Lincoln calls for 75,000 volunteers. It's 3 days later, on the 15th of April. War starts on the 12th. 15th of April, 3 days later, Lincoln calls for 75,000 volunteers. Okay. He says, look, we need you guys to help put down this rebellion. Now, the way it works, every state that's still part of the Union is going to have to give a portion of that 75,000. Okay? If you're a teeny state, not a huge population, say Vermont's not going to have to come up with as many guys as New York or Virginia. Okay? But everybody's going to have to put a portion into that 75,000. And therein lies the rub. Virginia is going to have to help give to that 75,000 and go invade South Carolina. Tennessee is going to have to contribute to that 75,000 and go invade Mississippi, right across the border. And you've got a lot of family and you've got a lot of shared experiences, and what's going to happen is four more states are going to say, I can't invade and attack fellow Southerners. We can't do it. It's not in us, and you can't force us to do it. The federal government is overstepping their bounds when they try and force us to do this. Okay, and so what's going to happen, go to this one again. See these gray states here? What's going to happen is those gray states are those upper South states, the last four that will join the Confederacy. Arkansas, Tennessee, North Carolina, and Virginia. They leave in response to that call for 75,000. They do not leave because of Lincoln specifically. Okay, Virginia met and voted Okay, Virginia leaders voted on whether or not they wanted to secede earlier in the secession crisis, and they said, no, we stay. After Lincoln calls for 75,000 volunteers, they vote to leave. Okay, that's why the Upper South goes. We will not march on fellow Southerners. We will not forcibly keep fellow Southerners in the Union. All right, we weren't going to leave because of the election. We were going to stay and try and work within the democratic process. But you cannot force Virginians to invade and march on South Carolinians. All right, and as much as North Carolinians, bless you, don't love South Carolinians, they still say we won't march. All right, we're not going to do it. And that's how you get those last four states into the Confederacy. Remember that. That's classic material for a chronology section where you're thinking about cause and effect. It's classic material to include in the essay. The other thing I want you to remember, what about those, what is that, green, teal, whatever color that is. All right, those are slave states that stay in the Union. Missouri, Kentucky, Maryland, Delaware. Slave states that stay in the Union, okay? Everybody has kind of in the back of their heads, all right, the slave states go in the Confederacy, the free states stay in the Union. No. You're going to have those border states that Lincoln has to deal with. His whole presidency, he's going to have to worry about more states going into the Confederacy, all right? And any position he takes against slavery, he's going to have to worry about losing those slave states and potentially more, all right? So this is going to be a constant thing he's going to have to think about. The other thing I want you thinking about, okay? Look at these areas for secession and against secession. Look at Mississippi. There are pockets in Mississippi, particularly in poor areas, particularly along the river systems, where they fear they're going to be right along a route of invasion, where they are just not so sure about this whole Confederate experience. Okay, Jones County, County of the North, is definitely going to be not necessarily pro-Union, but they're not going to be so sure about the Confederacy. There are pockets all over the Confederacy where you're going to have these sections that, again, are not necessarily pro-Lincoln, they're not abolitionists, but they're not so sure they're Confederates. And a lot of them are going to decide they absolutely are not. Okay, so even as the Confederacy is formed, even as more states are joining the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis is also going to have to balance the fact that you're going to have these divisions. All right, he's going to be constantly worried about governing sections of his own country. Okay, now, last but not least, okay, Lincoln, what did I tell you, 15th of April, Lincoln calls for the 75,000 volunteers. 19th of April, Lincoln calls for the Federal Navy, the U.S. Navy, to blockade all southern ports. That, by the way, is when he kind of de facto recognizes the Union, my future lawyer in the class. You can't blockade your own country, right? So by doing that, he actually recognizes the existence of those southern states as a foreign country. He was actually furious about that one, that his advisors didn't correct him before he did that. But, all right, 19th of April, 1861, Lincoln says the U.S. Navy is going to blockade all those southern ports. Nothing goes in, nothing comes out. Any of that money from cotton, any of that money from trade, we're not going to let those southern states benefit. We're not going to let those southern states get support from foreign countries, weapons, money, anything. Okay? The idea is we're going to cut the South off. That's when you're going to see more and more of these divisions, when that Upper South will not contribute to the 75,000, and where a lot of people are going to have to decide who they are going to side with. Okay? Robert E. Lee, the guy in the bottom left-hand corner of the slide, hopefully most of y'all recognize him. Okay? He's got a big decision. He's one of the most well-respected commanders in the entire U.S. Army. He's a graduate of West Point. He's been superintendent of West Point. He's a hero of the Mexican War. Okay? You guys know Arlington National Cemetery? That was his wife's family's home. All right? She is tied by family to Martha Washington. Robert E. Lee's father rode under George Washington during the American Revolution. Huge ties in his family to the founders of the country. Okay? And Lee's kind of split. There's this very famous quote that I wanted y'all to see where he talks about how I cannot raise my hand against my home, my children. All right? And a lot of folks have argued that Lee, by nature, was a Virginian. All right? More than anything else, Americans during this time period tended to identify themselves more as Mississippians. Okay, more as New Yorkers, more as Virginians than they did as Americans. Or they defined themselves by their state first, then by their nation. Okay, and that Lee, once Virginia goes, okay, yes, he has a national view, particularly as a man who served in the Army, who was stationed out in Texas. He has not spent his whole life in Virginia. All right, but he says, you know, when it comes down to it, that Lee very much viewed himself as a Virginian. Okay, part of it has to do with, too, though, that Lee is a slaveholder. All right, he has been for a long time. Yes, he did emancipate a large number of slaves. He emancipates more slaves that he inherits from his wife's family. But he's also, remember what I'm always talking to y'all about. Okay, don't try and make people 21st century people. Okay, view them within their times. And Lee was very much a man of his times. Okay, he very much believed in white supremacy. He very much believed in that old, remember the paternalistic argument we talked about when we talked about slavery in the Old South? Okay, very much argued about the role and the responsibility of Southern white male leaders within the community. All right, and that the basic social and racial organization of the South was how it should be. Okay. Remember Winfield Scott? When we talked about the Mexican War, the landing at Veracruz, you remember all that? Winfield Scott calls Robert E. Lee to Washington. He says, look, I want you to take command of these forces that we're organizing, the U.S. forces. All right, and Lee thinks about them, but then he writes and says, I cannot march on fellow Southerners. He goes home. He resigns his commission in the U.S. Army. All right, and he will later rise to the leadership of the Army of Northern Virginia and eventually to the leadership of all Confederate forces. Okay. That's the situation by the time we're in late, really, once you have the secession of all the Upper South, by the time we're in June, late May, June 1865. And when y'all get back on Monday is when we'll pick up with the start of the war. Now, do you want to go ahead? We can open up the mic if y'all want to be able to record any of the questions. Y'all are going to freeze at this point, though. You're like, oh, don't make me talk on television. All right? But do you have any questions? About Lee, Maria, go for it.
Fort Sumter was held by the North.
Yes? Yeah, it's a U.S. military installation.
Yes.
It'd be like, I don't know, Fort Hood in Texas. If Texas suddenly secedes and you've got a U.S. fort in the middle of this country. Yeah.
So they were kind of inside.
Well, it's all the United States, right? I mean, the question is, all right, Fort Sumter is in South Carolina, but it's the North. You know, what's going on here? Just wait until all the questions are done. All right. Oh, you're just saying the tendency to sheet round. Sorry, man. Don't mean to yell at you. You're fine. All right, everybody see South Carolina on the map? Okay? Do you not see South Carolina on the map? Here, it's right here. Here's South Carolina. Okay? So, we've got a U.S. fort in South Carolina. It's all part of the United States. South Carolina secedes, but you've got a U.S. military installation there. So what do you do with it? If you're the North, you're like, no way, we're not letting go because you're not allowed to go. All right, we're not leaving that fort. You can't tell us to leave. Okay? South Carolina is saying we're not part of the United States anymore. I mean, you might as well have a U.S. military installation in Mexico. All right? It's just not going to happen. You're not allowed to do that without our permission. Okay? And so what's happening is the guys in the U.S. Army who are stationed at Fort Sumter are saying, no, we stay. In some cases, you're going to get forts like in Texas where they basically, everybody kind of goes home. If you're from the North, you can go home to the North. If you're in the South, you're going to stay here. And a whole bunch of those weapons in this fort, we're just going to confiscate and Texas is going to use. Thank you very much. It comes to a head in certain spots, though. Florida came to a head, and it really comes to a head in Charleston Harbor at Fort Sumter. And that becomes the sticking point. And that becomes that crisis point of who's going to go where. Does that answer it?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Yeah.
Why did they fire on it if they knew they just had to keep the ship?
All you have to do is keep the ship. But what if you don't keep the ship away? Okay, number one. So theoretically, you're going to starve them out. But what if you fail to do that? All right, if the ship resupplies them, okay, they're going to be here and we're just going to be stuck in this purgatory. All right, but number two, are you an independent nation or not? I mean, at some point, they're saying, look, we're not saying we're going to go invade Washington City and then try and overthrow the U.S. government. But I am saying that you can't have a fort inside my country. And you're going to have to respect that. And there's some, just like there were Northerners putting pressure on Lincoln, are we going to go to war or what? There were Southerners putting pressure on Davis. Are you going to do something about this or what? All right, we broke away from the United States. We're not trying to steal anything, but you all need to leave. All right, and so you've got a chance for it to come to a head, and there's all sorts of pressure on Davis that, look, we're going to have to take a stand at some point, and maybe, all right, we said we wouldn't start this thing, but maybe if we do, it'll consolidate some of that support. Some of those folks who aren't necessarily sure if that was the smartest thing to do, this whole Confederate thing, maybe it'll consolidate that support and we can keep them. Did I get it? Okay. Casey, yeah.
In Alabama and the other map, why was there such a large concentrated area of people who were against the...
You get a lot of these areas, what you're going to see, I'm hitting four buttons at once. Anytime, you see where you get a border, where you're going to get any border between these states is where you're going to get a lot of trade back and forth. All right. It usually is if you have a lot of trade across these border regions, across river systems. It's also often going to be your more impoverished areas where you have people who feel like, they don't necessarily have a whole lot of say in this and are not so sure they trust these wealthy planners and what they're trying to do. The way the secession process kind of worked, a lot of historians have argued, there was kind of this upper tier of very wealthy planners who were just like, whoa, okay, everybody just chill out. But there were these guys who were kind of this new wealth. They were breaking out of that middle class kind of up into the wealthier areas that were saying, no, we need to do this. And if we do this, this is when I'm going to really rise to the top. And then you have a whole lot of poor whites who are saying, great, you guys are going to do this, and you're going to stay home, and you're going to make a whole lot of money, and I'm going to go out and die. Okay, and I'm not so sure about that. Okay, now you have a huge portion of the white male South that overwhelmingly supports this war, absolutely. All right, but you have pockets, okay, very isolated rural pockets is usually what it was, or they were on the borders and had ties to folks who hadn't seceded, who were just saying, no, I'm not so sure about this, all right? Or you'll run into other sections. There's a big German-American section over portions there in Texas is where that block is that are pro-Union. And again, when I say pro-Union, they're not necessarily in favor of Lincoln and abolitionists, as much as they're just not convinced about the Confederacy and that there's anything better for them in the Confederacy. And that's where you're going to see some breaks. Okay? So sometimes it's your very wealthy white Southerners, the guys who went Constitutional Union, who were just like, all this war is going to bring is a whole bunch of destruction. Sam Houston gets kicked out of his leadership in Texas. I mean, they flat out tell him to go home because he was pro-Union the whole time. I mean, Sam Houston was like, look, guys, I've been president of a country that's small and brand new. All right? It's hard. All right? And Sam Houston was your classic 19th century expansionist. I mean, he was about, I mean, you build more. He's like, go get Cuba, all right, and Mexico, and somebody up there, go take Canada, all right? You get more, you don't break away. He's like, are you guys nuts? All right, so you had those unionists for a variety of reasons. If you've ever, there's a great book called The Free State of Jones that looks at what Jones County does during this war. And again, not necessarily pro-Union as much as they are anti-Confederate and anti-the Confederate government and what they view as these very wealthy elite Confederates. Okay? Now, if there are any more questions, I want to let the folks who have 12 o'clock classes go, and I want to let the next class in. But if you have any more questions, come on down. Thank you, and we will see you Monday. Mickey? Can I shut this off?